Okay, well, as Travis shared, we are at the end of this series that we've been in. We've called Encounter Jesus. We've been in this series for about 4 months. This is our final week. And just to give us a quick recap or explanation of where we've been and why we've taught through this series, let me try to describe what the intention has been behind it. And in large part, we are trying to answer this question: what is God like? Okay, that's a pretty important question to ask and to answer. That actually determines a lot. Your answer to that question is really, really meaningful. What is God like? Now, the Sunday school answer is the right one. And what is God like? The answer is Jesus. Okay, God is like Jesus. Hebrews 1 says he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, Jesus is. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. And Colossians 1 says he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of creation, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. So if we want to know what God is like, we look at Jesus. And so we've been trying to look at Jesus. And for 4 months, we've been pulling stories out of the Gospels and just trying to get to know Jesus better and seeing how he would interact in different situations with different people and getting to know Jesus. But not only have we been trying to observe Jesus and understand what he's like, of course, we're trying to grow in our appreciation and our love for Jesus. So we've been using this statement: that's what I love about Jesus. Really been trying to have an answer or be able to complete that statement. That's what I love about Jesus. So there are a handful of things that I think have stood out over these months. And we've hit them from multiple angles with multiple stories, and there's some recurring themes. I could list some of these qualities that we could love about Jesus: his willingness to cross social boundaries. So many of our stories, Jesus was in a place where he shouldn't have been. It was awkward. He was associated with people he shouldn't have associated with. The way he gently redirects those who are straying, we see that throughout his life. His befriending of those others would avoid. His willingness to empty himself to make himself accessible. His compassion for the hurting. The way he intentionally pursues the outcast. Remember, he came to seek and save the lost, and he does seek, and he pursues especially those that are on the fringes of society. And these are things that we see about Jesus. These are things that we recognize about God, and these are things that we love. And we love these things about Jesus. However, as we wrap up, just as Travis explained earlier, this will be a little bit of a different message. And the difference, the way we could describe that difference, is that most of our messages thus far have highlighted what we could call the immanence of God. And today we're going to highlight the transcendence. If you're unfamiliar with those words, immanence is about God's nearness, his presence, his accessibility, his relatability, his touchability. And transcendence is really about, honestly, his distance, his otherness, his high aboveness, his set apartness, that God is entirely different and distinct than we are. Now, Christians, of course, see God as both. God is both transcendent and he is immanent. But when going through a bunch of stories from the Gospels, it is very natural to focus on his immanence, on his relatability. After all, Jesus is the way that God made himself accessible to us. And so when we're walking through those stories, of course, that is going to stand out, and we're going to see just how relatable God is through Jesus. But we must not neglect his transcendence as well. And so this morning, we're going to try to focus on that part of who he is a little bit more. And we are, instead of reading out of the Gospels, we are going to read out of Revelation. Now, as we dive into the book of Revelation, we're just going to read a short passage there, and we're not going to get into a lot of the thorny questions about timing and other interpretive conclusions that you can draw from Revelation. We are simply going to look at Jesus as the glorified king. And we're going to see the Apostle John's vision of who Jesus is, who he saw Jesus to be. So We're going to read Revelation 1, 9 through 19, and you can open up to that passage if you're using a house Bible. It's pretty easy to find. It's at the end. It's on page 1028. So let's read, starting in verse 9. I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. So John was imprisoned here. He was being kept on account of his testimony on this island. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus and to Smyrna and to Pergamum and to Thyatira and to Sardis and to Philadelphia and to Laodicea. So John is just on this island and he hears this trumpet-like thunderous voice behind him telling him to write and send it to these various churches. We could skip down to verse 19. It says, write therefore the things that you have seen, those that are and those that are to take place after this. So this passage is sort of bookended by these commands to write. John is to write this down, write what he sees, write what he hears. Now in between, John encounters who is speaking. He heard the voice behind him and then he turns to see. So let's go back to verse 12. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me. And on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace. And his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. So John gets this amazing vision and encounter with Jesus, the risen and glorified Jesus. Now, John, I think, is struggling to describe what he sees. You see a lot of simile here. There are a lot of likes. There's like this, like this. It's like he's grasping for vocabulary to try to describe what he is experiencing right now. It is beyond his experience. It is beyond what he could describe with normal language. This was so other, so overwhelming. So it's hard to say exactly what he looked like and exactly what was going on here, what this experience was like. But the point is that it was overwhelming, as we see in verses 17 and 18. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. And so, when John experienced this with Jesus, he couldn't even remain standing. He lost control of himself physically. He just fell down. He fainted. It was like he was dead when he experienced this. He couldn't even stand. And you know, I love the pictures that we can have in our minds of Jesus and Jesus gathering the little children and Jesus dining with tax collectors and touching the lepers. And those are really important pictures to have in our minds when we're considering Jesus and considering God. But I think we also have to have this one. Okay, in that catalog of pictures of Jesus in our minds, we've got to have this one as well, where Jesus is so overwhelmingly holy that humans can't even stand before him. There's something there that we need to grab onto. Now that's hard. It's hard to keep all these different sort of images of Jesus in our minds, but as we see God, he helps us see these seemingly paradoxical qualities and bring them together. But today we are going to try to focus on this picture of Jesus and see where that takes us. So our goal this morning is to at least cultivate this or take steps in this direction. Our goal is to see Jesus as the glorified King and to worship him accordingly. Or in other words, we're obeying Hebrews 12, 28 and 29. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. So again, he's certainly an accessible friend of sinners, and we want to see Jesus that way, but he is also a consuming fire, and he is the glorified King. And so we want to worship him accordingly. And we're going to do so in part now. Again, it's not something that we can fully attain. We won't experience what John experienced until the end. We truly see him. So we can only do it in part, but we do so anticipating seeing him fully in the future. And as we have that target in mind, it builds this sense of awe and reverence in us that we're going to pursue more and more, and we're going to worship him and glorify him as glorified King. So to do that, I'm going to first define a couple words even in that goal, and those words would just be glorified and King, and to have us understand what that means. When Jesus is full of glory, he's glorious, what are we talking about that there? And King also, what are we talking about there? So let's start with the word glorified or glory or glorious. You know, that's a word that is very common in the Bible. It's used over 400 times in both the Old and New Testaments. And sometimes it is used to describe the creation or even people or nations, sometimes negatively in that sense. But of course, the overwhelming majority of times it's used, it is describing God, that God is glorious, or we're being urged to give glory or glorify God, not that we can give him something that he doesn't have, but that we are acknowledging just how glorious he is. And yet, we may struggle with that word even. Like, can we define that word? Do we have an understanding of what we mean when we say God is glorious? It is a difficult word, especially because I think it's intended to sum up all of who God is. And so it's very multifaceted. It is hard to get your mind around what does that mean to be glorious. C.S. Lewis, in The Weight of Glory, describes his wrestling with the word. Okay, that he carried certain connotations of that word glory into his understanding that kind of distracted or messed with him a little bit. And so let me read his wrestling with the word glory. It says, glory suggests two ideas to me, of which one seems wicked and the other ridiculous. Either glory means to me fame, or it means luminosity. As for the first, since to be famous means to be better known than other people, the desire for fame appears to me as a competitive passion, and therefore of hell rather than heaven. As for the second, who wishes to become a kind of living electric light bulb? And so that's what he thought. That's, again, the connotation that he brought to this word, glory. One, it's fame. Two, it's brightness. And neither of those initially helped him that much. He explains further that they may help more than they seem at first. But at first, the word glory didn't do a lot for him. By the way, you should read Weight of Glory periodically. It's not a book. It's more of an essay. It was originally a sermon. It's 8 or 9 pages, I think. And so you should read it periodically. A lot of those kind of classic C.S. Lewis quotes are in this essay. But he is describing, again, his struggle with the word glory. So can we understand it a little bit more? Can we have some synonyms or ideas or categories in our minds as we wrestle with this word glory? Well, maybe we could go back and look at the kind of the etymology of the word, the history of the word, how it was used in different contexts in both Hebrew and Greek, the languages of the Bible. And here's how I understand it. In Hebrew, the word that is typically translated glory typically had this connotation, heaviness. heaviness and burden. Okay, so that was often how the word was used. This is what it implied. In Greek, apparently, the word was defined or associated with this, the condition of being shining. So that's what C.S. Lewis was referring to, shining, brightness, splendor, radiance. So does that help us at all? Well, I think it does, actually. I think that helps me. Glory, number one, indicates weightiness. It's weightiness, significance, substance, something that's that has grandeur. So that's part of it. It also indicates splendor, radiance, loveliness. So you could say it's both grandeur and splendor, or it's both strength and beauty. Kids, you might want to remember that right there. It's a little hint for you. Glory is strength and beauty, grandeur and splendor. It has this weighty significance. There's a magnificence to it, but it is also radiant. Now, again, in trying to approach the glory of God, we can't fully. And so we're grasping at something that we can't quite fully experience right now here in this world. But I think we can use some of the experiences in this world to help us. Again, we could go back to C.S. Lewis, and he says, heaven is, by definition, outside our experience, but all intelligible descriptions must be of things within our experience. And I think the idea here is that God gives us little tastes of glory in this world, just little tastes. We can't handle the fullness, but we do get little tastes of glory. And I think we're supposed to use those tastes to hone our anticipation of experiencing the fullness of his glory. And it takes a little bit of imagination. It takes a little bit of gathering together those experiences and then imagining what it could be like, what it will be like in the future. And so I want to try to help us imagine and help us use some of those familiar experiences to hopefully take us into more of an appreciation for his glory. After all, Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. And so the heavens are declaring, partially the heavenly host is declaring the glory of God, but also the creation is declaring it. What God has made is speaking something of his glory. So we can look around and we can see glorious things. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. We need to train ourselves to identify those shadows, those little glimpses, those tastes of glory, so that we can glorify God. What might that be for you? You know, those experiences of magnificence, of splendor, of grandeur that you have in this world. Maybe that's just looking at the night sky away from city lights, and you see the Milky Way, and you have that sense of smallness and that tingly feeling up and down your spine, and you're just experiencing grandeur, you're experiencing glory. Maybe it's on top of a mountain or at the edge of a cliff or on the ocean. You're experiencing grandeur and glory. I can give you some experiences for myself. My wife is from Alaska. Okay, so she grew up in Alaska before she came here for school. Her parents and her brother still live in Alaska, so we get occasionally we get to go back and visit and spend some time in Alaska. Let me tell you something about Alaskans. They're arrogant. Okay. They're arrogant about their state, okay, especially the size of their state, okay, that Alaska's big and has big things, and so they like to make that known. A few years back, our friend Case had his 40th birthday party, and actually it was many years ago, it was a long, long time ago, Case had his 40th birthday party. But Case is from Texas, and My wife was delighted to give him this gift. And I've never seen my wife so gleeful, like when she gave him this. It like just satisfied her soul to make this known. So Alaskans they're cocky and they're condescending. And they like to talk about how big their state is and all the things that are in their state. They're big mountains, but I will say that Colorado does have the most 14,000-foot peaks out of all the states and the highest average elevation. Now, Alaskans come back and they say, but your mountains start at 5,000 feet and go to 14, and ours start at basically zero and go to 20. But I don't think that's relevant, really. But they do have, I do have to admit, that although Alaskans are arrogant about their state, they do have reason to be. And it is a big state, but not just in surface area. It's got big things. It does have big mountains. It has big moose and bears and mosquitoes and fish and bodies of water. There's a lot of bigness in the state of Alaska. The last time we visited was two summers ago, and we got to do something that I had actually never done in our trips to Alaska, and it was that we got to go out on this day cruise outside of Seward, Alaska, and it was very popular that you can go on these little day cruises, and they take you out into the water and in and out of these fjords, and you get to see a lot of the bigness of Alaska. And when we went, it was just a perfect day. You know, sometimes it's 50 degrees and rainy, and it's kind of hard, but this was ideal. It was in the 60s and blue sky, and it was perfect, and we got to see some of that bigness of Alaska. And there are a couple things that stood out. One, There's this, and this is just approaching a glacier that is flowing into the sea. And we get actually a lot closer than that, but have this picture. You can see that little boat there, just for a reference for size. That boat's probably 60 to 80 feet long. And there's just this massive sheet of ice that is flowing down into the water. And you get closer, and the glacier is what they call calving, too. And so that's when these big chunks of ice break off of the glacier and slide down into the water and makes this thunderous noise and big waves. And you approach these glaciers, and you just get this sense of awe. There's just a sense of awe. Like this thing is grandiose, it's powerful. It's overwhelming, and you feel very, very small. And you have this sense that there is something mightier than me. And you just experience that. On the same day, we got to see some of these guys, and we saw a number of whales, and both orcas and humpbacks. And we got to follow this family of orcas. There's the mom and the dad and the calf that we got to follow them for about 20 minutes, and you see them come up every now and then. And these humpbacks were breaching as well. And again, when you get close to a whale, you have that sense as well. Just that sense of smallness, that sense of awe, a sense of glory. Like you're just tasting it. Just a little bit of glory that you're getting to taste, and it is overwhelming to some degree. And first of all, it's just kind of a wonder that we experience that all. You know, I experience that at all. You know, if we lived in a purely naturalistic world, I don't think we'd, one, experience things like consciousness and self-awareness, but I also don't think we'd experience awe. Just that sense that there is something beyond, something that transcends, something that's bigger than I am. But we do experience that. And again, it's pointing us somewhere. It's pointing us towards what is beyond. God is glorious. And he's going to reveal that glory in fullness one day. And right now, we just have these pale, incomplete experiences of glory, but they're still real and they're still pointing us somewhere. And I think we're supposed to seek them out a little bit. I think it's good, don't tell my wife this, but you should go to Alaska. Okay, you should visit because it's good for us to be around big things. Okay, we've got to put ourselves before big things every now and then and feel small and experience awe. It is, of course, healthy for the soul. Okay, so that's part of glory, and we have these experiences of glory, but Jesus is not only glorious, but he is the glorified King. He's not just this object that emanates glory, but he's a person. Okay, he's a king, he's a ruler, he reigns. Okay, he demands this respect and reverence. And so we also might think of him in those terms as we try to again imagine Jesus as the glorified King. Have you ever had a brush with authority or power or influence or fame or significance? I can tell you my brush with fame 20 plus years ago. I was in Breckenridge and I was at a movie theater. And I was standing in the ticket line at this movie theater with some of my cousins, and we were standing right behind Nick Lachey and Jessica Simpson. Most of you are like, I don't know who that is. Well, in the early 2000s, this was like the pop culture's golden couple for about 15 minutes or so they were. And they weren't quite like Travis, Kelce, Taylor Swift, but they were maybe in that ballpark. And so we stood behind them. I had this encounter with greatness here. But anyways, they were both famous. They were famous before they met each other. They were both pop stars, and then they got together, and so it was this big deal, and eventually got married, had a reality TV show. Eventually they broke up. But they were kind of that golden couple for a very, very short time, and so we stood behind them. It wasn't that big of a deal, but there was still this sort of sense like this is kind of significant. These are people that everybody kind of knows. They're on the magazine covers, and they're on TV, and they're sort of everywhere, and you just feel like, wow, this is kind of a big deal here. These people and everybody attaches this significance to these famous, talented people. And maybe you've had similar brushes with people that seem significant, at least in the world's eyes. And there's something that it does to you. Again, there's a reason people seem to fawn over these rock stars and pop stars and movie stars and there's just something that we associate with them. Like, this person is significant. There's something here that creates some sort of feeling in me. But of course, what makes that even more so is if somebody has authority. Like, not just fame, not just significance, not just talent, but also authority. If you've had a brush with authority, maybe you have had that brush with the authorities in some way. I remember when I was taking a trip to Honduras, and in Honduras, you just go about your business from place to place, and they have, you know, cops or security guards everywhere, but they have huge guns. Like, they're always holding these huge guns, and so you go to the gas station, and there's somebody there with a really, really big gun. And it just makes you kind of stand up straighter and sort of watch yourself, like, okay, there's a person here with some authority and some power, and I want to make sure I don't step out of line. And you have those experiences here and there. We honor that, and we kind of gravitate towards that, and we give it some sort of honor. And I think there's something in the human heart that does gravitate and seems to give some significance there, and even places trust in those significant people, and we have this desire for them to do something grand for us. And we see that throughout history. And so you go back to the Old Testament, and you see the Israelites demand for a king. If they really wanted a king, and they wanted a king just like all the other nations had, and they wanted somebody to lead them out into battle, somebody to represent them, there was so much significance in this person that had authority and power and that could represent them and lead them. Even today, even in a more independent, modern Western society, there you still see that sort of gravitation. I think in my own adult lifetime, I saw groups of people really put a lot of kind of Messiah-like faith in Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Different groups of people, not the same people. But you'd see people gravitate towards this one person thinking, this guy is going to rescue us. And he's going to lead us, and he's going to lead us into this kind of utopia. Now, that has always been the case, and that was certainly the case in the first century as well when John was writing the book of Revelation. And John wrote the book of Revelation because he was told by God to write it, and there are many different reasons I think God did direct him to write it. Many interpreters think that part of the reason that John wrote Revelation was that it was this kind of polemic against the imperial cult. That means he was confronting emperor worship with his writing. And certainly, Revelation contains a lot about future happenings and what things are going to be like in the end, but it also is probably addressing this tendency to put a lot of faith in an individual and to assume that they're going to take us to where we need to go and to redirect that sort of idolatry towards the one that really can take us. So looking at that imperial cult, you know, Caesar Augustus, he died in AD 14. After that, the Roman Senate officially declared him Divus Augustus, the divine Augustus, initiating state-sponsored worship across the empire with priests known as Augustales promoting his cult. And so at the start of a century there, the Roman emperors became divine in the people's eyes. And you could look at others. Caligula, he was probably one of the crazier ones. He openly demanded worship, had a temple built to himself in Rome, and installed a golden statue of himself in the temple of Jerusalem, though this was halted before completion. He appointed priests to serve in his personal cult during his lifetime. This was just very typical. Domitian had the same thing, had himself called, I'm not going to pronounce that, you Latin speakers will get upset with me, our Lord and God, and provincial cities dedicated altars and inscriptions to him as a deity before his death. This was just common throughout the first century. And I think it's common in humanity to want to give a lot of trust to these individuals and these leaders and suppose that somebody can take me to that promised land. But in Revelation, he's saying those people are all sorely lacking, but there is one, and there is one who can take you there. Like what Luke writes in his gospel about what Jesus said. He said, I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body and after that have nothing more that they can do, but I will warn you, whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. And we have such a tendency to fear and overly honor others. And Jesus is bringing us back and reminding us of who is to be feared, the one who is in control of our eternal destiny, and it is appropriate to fear him in the biblical sense, realizing that he is in charge of that eternal destiny. You know, in Luke 5, there was that interaction with Jesus that Peter had initially, and where Peter was fishing and he couldn't catch any fish, and then Jesus told him to throw his nets on the other side of the boat, and they had this huge haul of fish, and you may remember Peter's reaction. And he says, depart from me. Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. And that was the encounter that he had with Jesus, was that when he recognized the power that was within Jesus, He said, depart from me. I cannot be around you. I am a sinful man. Please leave. He just felt that. And I think that is part of the experience we should have. We should have when we imagine Jesus, when we imagine God, that's part of what should be included. That's not the full experience, as we'll fill that out in just a moment, but that is part of it. When we understand who Jesus is in all of his glory and all of his authority, it should cause this sense that we should fall down at his feet and recognize his greatness and fear him and even have this sense that we do not belong in his presence. Philippians 2, Paul says, therefore God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. That's the end. When every knee bows, everybody will fall on their face because they'll recognize fully who Jesus is and the authority that he has over every one of our lives. Okay, we're going to wrap up in just a few minutes here, but before we get to some of the implications for our life, I did want to go to our kids' question. And we've got a prize, so remember, we've been doing this all summer since we have our older kids, 7 through 12, in the service with us. We're offering them an opportunity to track with a sermon and then answer a question about the sermon and then win a prize. So we got a good one. We actually have a little game, family talk, with some cards here, but we also have some gift cards to Edison's Ice Cream. Okay, so this is one you want here. And remember the rules. If you've already won something this summer, don't raise your hand, but if you haven't and you're 7 through 12, you can raise your hand and answer the question. I'm going to try to call on the first hand that I see. And then Chad here will take the mic over, and you can share your name and your age with us and the answer to the question. But the answer, or the question, is just a simple definition. Let me flash it up here. What is glory? And I think the first hand I saw was way back there in the back, the last row. And so you can define glory in a lot of different ways. I gave you a little bit of a definition earlier.
I'm 11 years old, and my name is Riley, and the answer to that question is strength and beauty.
There you go. That's perfect. Yeah. All right. So we are to have some sense of the overwhelmingness of Jesus as we consider who he is and his holiness. But I want to, as we close up, I just want to answer this question a little bit. What difference does it make to see Jesus as glorified King, to have that overwhelming view of God? And to even long for him to depart from us, doesn't that seem kind of unattractive? But surprisingly, this view of God brings peace, and it even eliminates fear. And so I just want to go through a few quick points here. So what difference does it make to see Jesus as glorified King? Well, number one, it lessens the weight of your personal trials. Okay, when you know, so often our personal challenges, they seem really weighty, but when we see Jesus as weighty, as grand, as glorious, it does take away that weight, lessens that weight. Romans 8:18, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. When we gaze on Jesus like this, even though it's incomplete, even though it's not what we will, it still causes those personal trials, those personal weights, just to feel so much lighter. Not that they're insignificant, not that they go away, but compared to the glory that will be revealed to us, those weights come off of our shoulders. It also lessens the weight of our global concerns. I like Psalm 46:6, the nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. Yeah, all the nations are raging. All of those global leaders are raging. It seems like things are falling apart. Kingdoms are tottering. And then God utters a word and it all melts, because he is the one that is so far above everything else. And we can get so wrapped up with how everything is falling apart in the world. But when we see God in all his glory through Jesus, then that weight comes off as well. Number three, it eliminates entitlement and gives peace. It's kind of what happened to Job, if you're familiar with the story of Job. Job experiences amazing pain, amazing trial. And then God comes to him. At the end of the book, we read how God comes to him and displays himself. And God does not give Job a lot of answers as to the why all of those horrible things were happening to him. Instead, God just shows him his glory. And Job has that experience of glory. And at the end, Job says this to God: "I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know." When Job encounters the glory of God, then everything else just seems to pale in comparison. There's no longer this demand for what he sees as fairness. He just says, I didn't know. I am so far below. I have such a lack of understanding. God, you have the understanding. And so it removed that sense of entitlement, that sense of unfairness, and I think brought him into a place of peace. And then finally, it draws you into joyful dependence. And this is interesting how this works, almost counterintuitively, but I do believe this is how it works. When you see God in all of his glory and you fall down before him and you realize that you don't deserve to be in his presence, you don't have anywhere else to turn but him. You're fully dependent on him raising you up. So if we go back to our passage in verses 17 and 18, John says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead and just couldn't stand before him. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, 'Fear not, I am the first and the last.'" And so Jesus presented himself as the glorified king, and John couldn't stand until Jesus reached down and touched him, and he brought him up in his presence. And that's what Jesus does, and that's how it must happen. We can't stand until we realize that. We realize that we can't stand, we fall down, and then we let God pick us up. And all of us have to get to that point. And sometimes we have to get to that point over and over and over again, actually, where we realize God is greater. God is bigger than I am. He's far above. I can't stand. And then we surrender. Just as we sang about earlier, we just surrender and we throw ourselves at his feet and then let him pick us up. Band, you can go ahead and come on back up. And as they do, I'll just give us one more passage. I read the first part of this passage earlier, Luke 12, 4. I read 4 through 5, and let me add a couple more verses on. It says, "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have nothing more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 pennies, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, you are of more value than many sparrows." And it's interesting in this passage. First, it says to fear him. Okay, fear God, fear Jesus. It's appropriate to fear him. But then, as we do that, it transitions into this command to fear not. Fear not, because in his great power, his great authority, his great glory, he understands everything and he cares. He numbers every hair on your head, and he cares. You are worth more than many sparrows. And so he has this incredible authority, incredible glory. But because he has chosen to care for you, we can fear not.